Hello, this is Jennifer McCartney, and I'm going to be reading to you from my first novel, Afloat, as I sit here in Glasgow, Scotland, where I've been living for the past few months. And contrary to stereotype, it's a beautiful sunny day, so I'll be going outside in a moment. And Afloat is a novel set on Mackinac Island in northern Michigan in the present day, and also 50 years in the future in St. Paul, Minnesota. And I'll read a bit from the beginning and then skip ahead a few pages. Your right hand, palm inward, thumb out, is the state of Michigan. Mackinac Island is off the tip of your middle finger. Green and heavy, this limestone outcrop of land lies in the Straits of Mackinac between the lakes of Huron and Michigan. The island is 9 miles around with a forest in its middle, and it takes 1 hour to circle it by bicycle. You cannot travel by car because there are none. The narrow road surrounding the island, the M-185, is the only highway in North America on which there has never been a motor vehicle accident, although the cemetery is full. The weather intrudes like a clenched fist. During the winters, the 500 horses are taken away to a southern state. It was May. The island lay underneath a sky shaded like the underbelly of a fish. I will tell you everything that comes next. The exact events of that summer, so you can understand what I am waiting for now. It is 12:05 p.m. I have 6 hours until my visitor arrives. Enough time for everything to happen again. Page 38, St. Paul, Minnesota, 1:35 p.m. With my chocolate-covered nightgown in the garbage, Anna helped choose my outfit this morning. The decision of what to wear was difficult. If the storm arrived as predicted, I would need to be warm, which meant unflattering woolen socks, full cotton underwear, and a long-sleeved shirt, which in turn meant unearthing the large Tupperware container marked winter clothing from the basement. If the storm veered or dissipated, as they often did, the temperature would stay relatively the same. Rapid weather patterns, the government calls them. Appearing fully formed on radar and disappearing as quickly, they are exact, perfect storms with a disciplined set of precipitation rings that destroy everything underneath. I've experienced only one, though there have been many warnings. The first three appeared in rapid succession over a period of 2 days in California, and the images were fantastic. Buildings covered in ice, flooded with 3 feet of water, everything glistening in the quiet aftermath, holes punched through cars and roofs by hailstones. The property values for the homes left standing dropped so quickly, those who weren't displaced simply left. Santa Fe and Salt Lake took most of the influx, the first city by choice, the second by charity. I was in Monterey for the opening of the Sun Palms, the first of the big resorts the government built to bring in revenue for the rebuilding effort. Meredith and I went in expensive bikinis, drank too much, and met a military man. He'd been from the Bay Area, which was still underwater, and when the cannonballs of hail hit, he'd been walking his dog, Mobius. A real pretty beagle, the man told us. When the hail stopped, there was nothing left on the end of his leash but pulp, and he was barely conscious anyway, floating down his own neighborhood street in 13 hours worth of rain, hail, and snow. I wanted to know what happened next, and he said a family in Bountiful had taken him in, their ward helping him through his journey. A Mormon family, and I nodded. We all looked out over the water together. What I wouldn't give for a boiled egg, he told us. But all the chickens had died years ago from the flu. When I left California, its border rendered as arbitrary as I guess it ever was, I brought a t-shirt for Alan that said, I survived California's RWPs and all I got was this lousy t-shirt. But he wouldn't wear it, and I suppose he was right. He usually kept my poor taste in check.